Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Between 2016 to early 2020, roughly 5 million young Latino Americans became eligible to vote. In 2018, Latino turnout hit a record high to almost 12 million. And in 2020, the total size of the Latino electorate is now north of 30 million, making Latino Americans the largest minority group headed to the polls this year. Now, let's take a moment to fully acknowledge that no group of Americans is monolithic. This is especially true of Latinos, but it is also inescapable that Latino Americans have a critical and increasingly powerful voice in this election. So this hour on Point, we'll talk with members of the Latino community about the issues and policies that matter to them in the 2020 race for the White House. And we'll start right here in the studio with Julio Ricardo Varela. He is the digital media director for Futuro Media. He's also the founder of LatinoRebels.com and co-host of the podcast In the Thick. Julio, welcome to On Point.
I'm so excited to be here.
So first of all, let's just, you know, we just came off of the South Carolina primaries this weekend on Saturday, and Joe Biden's win there. Do you think that that's going to have an impact on Democratic Latino voters who are headed to the polls for Super Tuesday?
What a great yes and no.
Yes and no.
So which is like, I think obviously we, you know, during this election cycle, who knows what's happening? You know, you have Mayor Pete Buttigieg dropping out on Sunday night. I don't think anyone expected that. And I think it's tossed a lot of – there's a lot of questions. But with that said, looking at the polling, looking at what has happened with Latino voters and this outreach by the Sanders campaign, Bernie Sanders is – you know, he had – I don't know if you saw the rally in Los Angeles. He had a lot of people. There was 35,000 RSVPs, and he's leading in those polls with Latinos by far. I believe there's going to be a Univision poll that's going to drop later this afternoon that's going to confirm that. And also he's leading pretty big in Texas. So those are the two big delegate-rich states. And saying that Latinos are might carry him to both those states. So I don't know if the South Carolina victory by Biden is going to help him in places like California, Texas, or even Colorado, which also has a significant population of Latinos.
So do you – well, we can talk about the things that individual candidates are saying to Latino voters. We'll do that more later in the hour. But do you get a sense that this year really could be pivotal in terms of as I said, the power and the influence that Latino Americans have on a White House race?
Yes, I think so. And I think the Nevada caucus really surprised a lot of people. You know, Sanders was leading with Latino voters, but I don't think people, you know, as much as Biden won big with black voters in South Carolina, Sanders crushed Biden in Nevada. And that kind of brought attention to a lot of people. Like there was a range that, you know, he won, like the entrance poll said he won like 51, 52% to Biden's, like, you know, in the teens. And that one really was like, whoa, like this is a big deal. So I do think that what you're seeing, especially with what happened in the midterms and even parts of 2016 with this electric being younger, mm-hmm. being more progressive, really kind of seeing their place in a Trump administration, you know, that they're kind of becoming more politically engaged. And also I would say more independent. They're not affiliated to parties. They might lean Democratic, but if you look at, you know, surveys that have come out from the National Association of Latino Elected Officials, NALEO, you see that there's a lot, you know, as many Democrats, as many Latinos who identify as Democrats, like in the 30-40% range, you have them not affiliated by party. Mm-hmm. So I do think in the end, there's this push of like trying to put the community first. And those candidates that have really spent money on the campaign are the ones that are doing well. And Bernie Sanders is a perfect example.
Okay, so trying to put the community first, what does that mean?
This is a great question. Basically not saying that Democrats have our vote, not taking us for granted. And I think that's something that you need to understand. There's I hate to say the word establishment, but I'm going to say it. A traditional Democratic electorate, that has been Latino has been older, a little bit more moderate. And I do think that that might happen in a place like Texas with Biden. So it's still up in the air. But what you're seeing is more grassroots, more younger people who are getting politically engaged for the first time. Has to do a lot with the Dreamer movement and immigrant rights activists that have been doing this for 10 years. They are now voices in this space. So and take the example of Nevada. Everyone's like, oh, Latinos showed up. Like, they've been showing up for 10 years. Like, they're the ones that got Harry Reid elected as senator. They're the ones that got Cortez Masto, the first Latino senator in the United States, elected. So this notion of this quote-unquote sleeping giant, it's been awake.
Uh-huh.
And I think what it is that media is finally, like, catching up to the story. And it's like, oh, this – and I'm like, I've been covering this for, 15 years, guys. Like, welcome to the party.
Well, we've been focusing on Democratic voters.
Yeah.
I also want to actually expand the conversation a little bit later to the Latino electorate overall, because we were talking this morning how reminding ourselves that one in five Latino voters that cast a ballot, who cast a ballot in 2016, cast it for President Trump. So like the diversity within the Latino community is significant, and that's also part of the story, I think.
Yeah, and it's regional too. So I think, people when they hear the Latino vote, it's like, yes, there is a Latinos for Trump. And if you actually go to the Trump campaign, it's part of the campaign's platform. There's board members. It's, the best way I can describe it, it's a whiter Latino electorate. It's more affluent. Uh-huh. It's more evangelical. It's more, I would say, right-wingish in terms of, we don't want Cuba or Venezuela taking over our country. I think there's something there. But I think it's very valid. It speaks to that, to sort of how you do have ideological differences that, to be honest with you, come from our home countries.
Mm.
One of the things that I think people tend to forget is that the left and the right in Latin America, there's really not a lot of middle in Latin American politics. So when you come from that world and you bring it to a place like the United States, there's a lot of, I kind of tend to think like this is sort of like a Latin American style election where it's like, the populist right versus the populist left, and the middle's trying to figure out what to do right now. And I think Latinos really get that. And I think what you're seeing is, it's no longer about the Florida Cuban conservative vote. You have a lot of Puerto Ricans in Central Florida, and the West and the Southwest and the South, other parts of the South, fastest growing sections for Latino voters. There's a reason why Bernie Sanders is doing well in California. He's going to do well in Colorado. He's done well in Nevada. He'll probably do well in Arizona. There's a lot of Mexican American progressive voters who kind of are like, we get it. We understand. Bernie Sanders is sort of what I say. It's like it's sort of a testament to sort of the early Chicano activist movement in a lot of ways. People understand his message.
Well, Julio just gave me an idea, but we should do a future show about lessons learned from Latin American elections.
I'm down. I'll show up again.
2020 presidential
race. Anytime.
Well, we are talking about Latino voters, the Latino electorate in the United States in the 2020 race for the White House. Julio, stand by here for just a second because I want to bring in now Geronimo Cortina. Geronimo joins us from Houston, Texas. He's Associate Director of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Houston and Associate Professor of Political Science there as well. Geronimo, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. And also with us from Los Angeles is Sonia Diaz. She's founding director of UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. She previously worked as an advisor to then California Attorney General Kamala Harris's campaigns for AG in California. So Sonia Diaz, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me just first ask you, Sonia, the same question that I asked of Julio. Do you think that 2020 is going to be a pivotal year in terms of the importance, belatedly recognized or not, the importance of Latino voters in America?
Absolutely. And I think that we have two things to point us in this direction. First is the Latino electorate's pivotal performance in the 2018 midterms, whereby of the 40 seats that changed from Republican control to Democratic control in the House of Representatives, half of those seats occurred in high-density or majority Latino precincts. And so precincts that had Latino registered voters were the precincts that moved and changed Congress. Now, going into 2020, a few things have changed. There are now more Latino voters because we're just such a young population that we age into the electorate. But more than that, there have been a change in tactics that I think were informed both by lessons learned in 2016, but most recently the successes and the return on investment in the Latino electorate that 2018 yielded.
Tell me a little bit more about change in tactics.
Yeah, I think that we see this best with Senator Sanders, where in 2016, he was not the person that was seen as someone having the most diverse staff at all levels, whether it was from senior advisors to field staff. And that's radically changed today. We know that he has said that he's hiring locally. A lot of his staff are coming from these battleground states and from states with large populations of voters of color. And they're providing different types of ways to engage the electorate, whether it's tamales with Theo Bernie or types of door knocks and barnstorms. These are just different tactics than we saw from this particular candidate a little over 3.5 years ago. And akin to Senator Sanders, we saw Senator Warren start this year in January rolling out a plan for Latinos in the United States.
Huh. Well, Geronimo, we've got about 45 seconds till we have to take our first quick break here. But let me just let you have a crack at this. Are you seeing that kind of change in tactics there in Texas?
Well, absolutely. I think that it's very important how the Democratic Party and to a certain extent the Republican Party have tried to court the Latino vote, especially within this change of demographic change in the state, meaning that you have more younger millennial and Generation Z voters being incorporated into the electoral role. And that has changed the tactics for political parties.
Interesting. So age really one of the major factors here. We'll dig into a lot more about the policies themselves that matter to the Latino community when we come back. We are talking about the rising power of Latino Americans in the 2020 race for the White House. There's more to come. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about Latino Americans and their rising power and influence in the 2020 race for the White House. Yes, especially as we are on the eve of Super Tuesday on the Democratic side of the ledger. I'm joined today by Julio Ricardo Varela. He's a digital media director for Futuro Media. Geronimo Cortina joins us as well. He's associate director of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Houston. And Sonia Diaz is with us. She's founding director of UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. And let's just get a caller in here while we can. Let's go to Monica, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Monica, you're on the air.
Hi. So I have a question and a comment. I consider myself Latina, and my family's from Peru. I am also a millennial, and I'm a mom. And I am wondering, I suppose, what the guests have to say about the... I want to say it's more or less a discrepancy between the African-American vote and the Latino vote. If Biden, by and large, won the... I think they're saying now that he's won more or less the popular vote over Sanders. How do you explain the fact that African American voters, at least on this primary, have more or less put their weight behind Biden, and Latinos have more or less put their weight behind Sanders. I also don't want to describe Sanders, how well he's doing among the African-American vote, because I get the impression that people are more or less over-exaggerating how well he's doing, because his message has more or less been that he's a coalition builder. I'm also a Warren supporter, and I'd say that I'm personally really disappointed with how poorly she's done among Latinos, especially because Julio Castro has put his weight behind her as a surrogate. And for me, I mean, personally, on an anecdotal level, it just feels like there's some level of misogyny against Warren that people don't want to articulate. And I also want to say that, like, no offense, Julio, I always get the impression from your blog that you're a pro-Bernie person. So it's just kind of hard seeing the way the Latino vote has gone in this election.
Okay.
Thus far.
Monica, you've actually brought up like five really interesting points. So let me thank you for your call. We'll dig into them. And Julio, did you want to just first of all respond to
First of all, thank you, Monica, for the question. We run a commentary and opinion site, and we also were the first site that published Senator Warren's Puerto Rico plan. And we also were the first site that published Senator Warren's endorsement of over 100 Latino and Latina leaders. So I mean, personally for me as an editor, it's not accurate. I mean, we do have some contributors who support Bernie Sanders, but at the same time, we cover the election through our Associated Press. And in the end, the reality is that Sanders is winning elections, and so is Joe Biden. So with that said, I get it. But at the same time, I also think the issue of the black vote versus the Latino vote is an issue to consider. We will find out more about this tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to look at the fact that if you do look at Nevada, Sanders did better with African-American voters. South Carolina, to me, feels like an outlier for Biden because that's always been his state. But at the same time, the Democratic Party, let's be honest, has put millions and millions and millions of dollars into the African-American outreach vote for years. And I think they're just waking up to the Latino vote and being like, oh, maybe we should invest. Maybe we should invest. And the Bernie Sanders campaign, like Sonia said, it's like they literally strategically said, I learned from 2016. Like they said, we learned from 2016 and we want to invest more money in 2020.
Yeah.
But I think it's valid about Warren. I think it's valid about Warren, what the caller brings up.
So, Sonia and Geronimo, I'm just going to ask you to stand by here for a second because I'm sure you have some things to add to this conversation. But for a few minutes, we have got on the line now from San Antonio, Congressman Joaquin Castro, Texas congressman whose district includes San Antonio. He's the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and he's also former mayor of San Antonio. And yes, as you heard our caller Maria said, Congressman Castro's brother, Julian Castro, former presidential candidate as well. So, Congressman Castro, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, good to be with you. Now, my brother Julian was actually the mayor of San Antonio and then HUD secretary and then presidential candidate. And I was in the state legislature and then went to Congress.
Do you know what? That was the one thing I was hoping that I would not do today, which is to do that thing with the twin brothers. And I am so sorry, Congressman. That is
okay.
Shameful. So, all right, I'm gonna do some penance for that one. Being used to it is not okay. So, Congressman Castro, let me reset my brain here and just ask you first of all. So, we're having this conversation about the importance of the Latino electorate. Interestingly, you heard Monica just then, our caller, ask about, is there a discrepancy between African American voters and Latino voters? That's a pretty big question, and I'm just wondering. As chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, what do you think about that?
I do think it's an interesting question. I don't think that we know the answer to that yet until we see a lot more states vote. I think we need to keep in mind that there are only four states that have voted so far. Super Tuesday will go a long way in telling us more. Remember, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden come in as the two best-known candidates in the race. And I think that in the analyses that I've seen so far, I think folks aren't accounting for that enough, that by getting your name out there, in the case of Joe Biden as vice president, in the case of Bernie Sanders, having run before in 2016, that goes a long way in helping you with every population. And for the other folks that didn't run, remember at one point, I'm supporting Elizabeth Warren now. At one point, my brother was in the race. It is difficult for everybody else to get the same level of name ID out there. But I also agree with Julio's point about the investment in Latino voters. For years in places like Texas, states that were not considered competitive in a presidential election, oftentimes Latino voters were just not talked to. They weren't the people, because a lot of them had not availed themselves of the political process. They had not gone to vote before or voted rarely. They weren't getting the door knocks, the phone calls, the mail pieces, the things that would engage somebody to go vote. And what you see now in many places is that that's changing, because in Texas we have a competitive primary. We also have many more Democrats that are challenging incumbent Republicans in congressional districts, in state legislative districts. So there are more campaigns and more outside organizations that are doing the work of reaching Latino voters. And I think that's why you're seeing in the Texas primary, for example, that you've got an increase in the participation of Latino voters, because people are actually reaching out to them.
So this has come up a couple of times in terms of ground game or direct outreach to voters. That's one thing about in politics. But I also wonder about the policies behind that the candidates actually stand for, because ultimately that's what matters. Ideally, that's what would bring voters to the polls. So do you see candidates, let's focus on the Democratic side for a second, Congressman, do you see candidates actually doing a better job in terms of formulating policies, supporting policies that are meaningful to the Latino community?
I do. You know, when you think about, I mean, I represent the fairly working class district in San Antonio, and there are homes in my district that are worth $30,000 and homes that are worth $1 million. That's the range of houses in my district. And so for a lot of people, you know, it's nuts and bolts issues of education, mostly for their kids, but also for themselves, health care, because Latinos have the highest percentage as a community of folks that are uninsured, and then jobs, making sure that people have a job, but not just that they have a job, that they're making a wage where they can actually afford to support themselves and their family members. So Democrats in 2020 have been talking a lot about those issues, and I think you see that resonating with the Latino community.
And what about, let's talk more about immigration, though. Are Democrats doing a good enough job to reach out to, say, Republican members of the Latino community who might have feelings of doubt or uncertainty about this administration and immigration? Is there outreach happening to those voters?
Yeah, I think as far as I can tell, since the time that Donald Trump kicked off his candidacy by talking about Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, since then there's been a concerted effort really to court Latino Republicans, Hispanic Republicans, who in the past supported Republican candidates. And I think that has paid dividends in some races across the country. And that continues today because the president's posture towards immigrants has been so toxic and so divisive. Mm-hmm.
Well, Congressman Castro, hang on here for just a second, because I do want to let Sonia Diaz, one of our other panelists this hour, get back in here. Sonia, what do you think about what Congressman Castro is saying?
I think it's important, but I'm so excited about what's going to occur on Super Tuesday. Thinking through the polls that we know from Univision for both California and Texas, there's some distinct differences, and that's happening after Tom Steyer and Mayor Pete dropped out of the race. So in California, Sanders is leading Latino registered voters by almost 11 points over Vice President Joe Biden. Now, Congressperson Castro's absolutely right about name recognition. That said, Texas is going to be our unicorn of sorts to really understand moderate Latinos. So what we see in Texas amongst the polls for Latino registered voters is Bernie leading, followed by Bloomberg, and then VP Biden. Mm-hmm. And so where Bloomberg really has not polled well in California, he has in Texas. And again, I think it's really interesting because I think it presents an opportunity for Latino voters who are not in sync with Senator Sanders to choose somebody else. And in Texas, at least through the polls, it's going to be seen tomorrow whether or not they will come and cast a meaningful ballot for Mike Bloomberg and what his positionality in this race is. Now, I'll say he's been spending a ton of money in California, which has almost 12 media markets.
Right.
What we've seen in California is we have seen Senator Warren with, you know, a field office and Latino staffers, but California really got on the bandwagon and was competitive for Senator Sanders in 16. And going into 20, there is a lot of culturally competent tactics. So not only are there media buys, but you're also thinking about different types of surrogates. So we know that Secretary Castro has come out in favor of Senator Warren and has been going throughout the Southwest as a chief Latino surrogate. Well, Bernie has AOC. He also has a lot of local level elected officials and community organizations. Mm. And I think that this is going to be an outcome in terms of both tactics and if media and money can buy the Latino vote.
Yeah. Well, Julio, I know you had a question for Congressman Castro before we have to let him go.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Congressman, quick question. Your candidate, I mean, she has, you know, in Massachusetts, she's very well loved by the Latino community, especially by Puerto Ricans. She's, you know, your brother endorsed her. You ran your brother's campaign. Why has she not resonated as much, at least with polling with Latinos and even with the recent results like in Nevada?
No, I mean, I think that she's made an incredible effort. I think her policies are appealing to the Latino community. Like I said, she's competing against two guys that are very well known and have worked for years also to court the Latino community. And I think that she'll do well on Super Tuesday. I think she'll do better than people expect. You know, as you know, my brother and I were both critical of New Hampshire and Iowa being the first states that vote. I think one of the disadvantages of that to the Latino community, because there aren't there are Latino communities in both those states, but there aren't large Latino communities, is that candidates spend basically a year courting the first few states and then a few weeks courting everybody else as they ping pong around the country. And I think that actually detracts from a candidate's ability to try to connect with and court the Latino vote. And I would say the same thing about the Asian American vote and the African American vote.
Well, Congressman Joaquin Castro, Texas Congressman and Chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Geronimo Cortina, you've been very patient waiting there, and I appreciate that a lot. But jump back in here and respond to what you heard the congressman saying about the efficacy with which various candidates are courting the Latino vote.
Yes, absolutely. I think, well, first of all, name recognition is going to be very important. You have Vice President Biden, 8 years on the spotlight. So that increases, name recognition, and that propels him one way or the other within the Latino community. But the other important issue is that when you look at the issues that Latinos really care about, for example, in this case, lowering healthcare costs, then you have Bernie Sanders, that is the candidate that has used, Medicaid for all and talking about healthcare costs since, I can remember. So that resonates very well within the Latino community in terms of the issues that are their priority. And it's also important to say that, these issues show that the Latino electorate in a state of being a heterogeneous voting bloc shows that they're paying attention to the issues.
Yeah.
And so they cannot, or candidates cannot just, shine a little mirror and say, well, vote for me because I know a couple of words in Spanish. But now they have to really do their homework and really talk about the issues, because with this demographic change, it shows that the Latino electorate is as sophisticated as any other type of voter in the country.
Yeah. Well, so
that's right.
Yeah. Let me just dovetailing off what Geronimo just said, do you think that there's a risk of candidates taking Latino voters for granted?
Absolutely. And I take it beyond just candidates, but the national parties. Mm-hmm. I think that Latino voters and voters of color have been taken for granted. I think that their issues and their concerns have not been front and center in terms of either party's agenda. And in fact, for one party in particular, Latinos are villainized. And we need to do an about face there because we are going to determine who's in power for generations to come alongside our other growing population, minority population, which is Asian Americans. So in terms of candidates taking Latinos for granted, the 2018 midterms were remarkable in showing what the Latino electorate is capable of and also recognizing that part of the reason that Latinos have not voted are twofold. One, some people are ineligible. We're a young population. You have to be 18 and a citizen to vote. The second thing, and I think this is really important, we have to always remember this, which is that there's been an attack on our voting rights, and there is widespread voter suppression that targets communities of color. So as we go into Super Tuesday, we're going to be in a state that wants to dilute the Latino vote.
Well, we are talking about the growing power and voice of Latino American voters. I'm joined today by Sonia Diaz, Geronimo Cortina, and Julio Ricardo Varela, and we'll hear from more callers when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the growing power and voice of Latino American voters, especially in the context of the 2020 race for the White House. I'm joined today by Sonia Diaz. She's founding director of UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. She's with us from Los Angeles. Geronimo Cortina joins us in Houston, Texas. He's associate director of the Center for Mexican American Studies and the University of Houston. And Julio Ricardo Varela is with us today in the On Point studio. He's digital media director for Futuro Media and founder of LatinoRebels.com. And, you know, we've been talking about outreach to Latino American voters in the context of this campaign. Let's listen to a little bit of how some Democratic candidates flexed their sort of Spanish-speaking muscles, or at least their high school-level Spanish, in the first Democratic presidential debate.
Me llamo Julián Castro, y estoy postulando por presidente de los Estados Unidos. The very fact that I can say that tonight shows the progress that we have made in this country.
La situación ahora es inaceptable. Este presidente ha atacado, ha demonizado los inmigrantes. Es inaceptable y voy a cambiar este.
Vamos a tratar cada persona con el respeto y dignidad que merecen como humanos.
That's Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, and Julián Castro, three candidates that I should note who are no longer in the race, actually, at all, which maybe that's something worth talking about as well. But meanwhile, for example, in Texas, Democratic presidential candidate Mike Bloomberg's campaign now accounts for 80% of the presidential ad buys in Texas, according to the Dallas Morning News. And here's one of those ads.
No podemos seguir divididos en un mundo convulsionado. Por eso Mike Bloomberg ha decidido lanzarse para presidente con determinación, honestidad y experiencia.
And that ad says, we cannot continue to be divided in a world in upheaval. That's why Mike Bloomberg decided to run for president, applying his determination, honesty, and experience. Julio, I mean, language
yeah,
is important, and outreach is important, but how much of this... Okay, speaking in language that addresses issues directly important to some voters, important. But how much of this is pandering?
Well, let me just say a couple of things. First of all, I think there's a lot – not saying that people that dominate Spanish in this country who are voters I think it's important. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think it's important. Right? There's a tradition of it. But I also think it's being overrepresented, because when you actually look at real Pew data about this Latino population, it's younger, it's more quote unquote assimilated, it's more English speaking, it's more bicultural. So what Sonia's talking about, sort of that cultural competency and people coming from the community, and what Jeronimo's saying about, you know, healthcare is important, all those things matter. And I think it's important. And one of the things that I kind of take issue with this whole, like, Iowa, New Hampshire are white. And Sonia, I'm going to call out your excellent work on this. When Iowa came out, people are forgetting that the Sanders campaign actually micro-targeted Latino majority caucus sites. You know, there are immigrant communities in Iowa. And when you look at the numbers, and Sonia, you can correct me, I think it was over like 51, 52%, even close to 60%, that Sanders took those caucus sites. And there's an argument to be made that that margin actually helped him get the popular vote. Also, take a city like in New Hampshire, like Nashua, New Hampshire, which is a border, you know, which is an exurb of Boston, very immigrant community, very diverse, much more reflective of the American electorate. Sanders took that one by a lot, too. So this notion that Latinos just suddenly appeared in Nevada and we're going to go to California and Texas, I just think is so simplistic. And I just want to kind of get into a more complex conversation about the fact that, you know, like what Sonia and Jeronimo are saying, it's like, we're here.
Yeah.
Like, just invest in us.
Sonia, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. What we found at UCLA in terms of Iowa in high-dense and majority Latino precincts is that they overwhelmingly supported Senator Sanders. And we believe that Senator Sanders' pickup in those caucus sites made it so that he was a top finisher with Mayor Pete in that state. Now, going to Nevada, our research showed that in the Latino caucus sites, Latino registered voters caucus for Senator Sanders at 70%. So of all registered voters in that state, 70% of them selected Sanders. And a lot of that was because there was meaningful investment. In Iowa, the first mailer that went out from the Sanders campaign was bilingual. Now, this is a state that's 90% white. In Nevada, the first field office that was open for the Sanders campaign was in East Las Vegas, which is predominantly Latino. These are signals that the Latino vote not only matters, but is consequential to the success of a campaign. And that's what Latino voters need. They don't need pandering. Right. They don't need to be told they're important. They need action, not just from candidates, but from the political parties.
Right. So, Jeronimo, let me ask you about that, because my mind keeps coming back to the very centrally important issue of immigration across the United States. And because, yes, healthcare, the economy, jobs, those are going to be important to American voters, and obviously including Latino American voters. But we actually haven't talked about immigration that much. And the reason why I want to drill down into it is because I think it's the perfect lens to look through this question of the parties taking Latino American voters for granted, right? Because we're all old enough to remember here in the days of George W. Bush and big tent Republicanism that there was this thought that the Republican Party could be a welcoming home for
Bush did very well.
And he did very
well. Record well, like close to 40% in his reelection.
But for a whole variety of reasons, immigration and the insolvable problem, it seems, of immigration being one of them, that is not at all what happened. And now we have a completely different Republican Party. Let's put it out there. But, you know, the Democratic Party also didn't get immigration solved either. So Jeronimo, I guess what I'm building to is, as Sonia said, if we don't have policies that actually cross the finish line to accompany the outreach, what good does all of this do for all that outreach do for Latino voters?
Well, it's not going to do any good. Yeah. And the simple answer to that is that, you know, pandering or these approaches with cultural sensitivity, to put it nicely, are simply not going to work. And why is the case? Because, once again, Latinos are paying attention.
Yeah.
And they want policies. They want bread and butter issues to be solved. They want cheaper healthcare. They want improving wages and income. They want the government to create more jobs. And when politicians diverge and start talking about, for example, issues about immigration, actually, they're not talking to the Latino electorate, right? Mm-hmm. Immigration immigration, it is indeed an important issue for Latinos, but not all Latinos care about immigration. You have Latinos are fifth generation, right? So they don't really care about issues about immigration or border crossing or something like that. They resonate. I'm not saying that they're not important, but other issues are higher in that list. Why? Because they want to send their children to college. They want a good job. They want to be able, if they get sick, to be able to pay the medical bill. And when immigration is used or weaponized, actually, some politicians are talking to a very particular part of the electorate that are going to get motivated to go to the polls, talking about and weaponizing immigration and demonizing it as something that is, you know, bad for the country, when all the studies have shown that immigration is a net positive for the country.
I agree a lot with what Jeronimo is saying, but I also think one of the things that you've seen from the Latino community because of this sort of immigration fatigue is sort of an understanding that there's a holistic, like, approach to it that, that, you know, the Obama administration and its immigration enforcement strategy, and it comes from the Dreamer movement, and it comes from the immigrant rights activists, of which a lot of these activists are now in campaigns, like in the Warren campaign and the Sanders campaign, that there is this feeling, and it is a reality, that the Democratic Party let the Latino community down. The broken promise of President Obama, I know it sounds like a broken record, and you know, when I bring it up, Democrats like to slap me on the head and be like, oh, it's not like Trump. I'm never saying it's like Trump. But that is an issue, and that is an issue that Joe Biden, to be honest with you, couldn't shake for a year. Yeah. And actually, this is where a little bit of pandering comes in. When he finally said this was a mistake, the deportation record, when he did the interview with Jorge Ramos, the day, like right, like before the Nevada caucus, there were a lot of Latino voters who were like, that was too late, Mr. Vice President. And I think we have to, and I agree with both Sonia and Jeronimo, Latino voters are American voters. They're not stupid. They follow these issues. They're incredibly engaged. They want to engage the political process. And this is one example of the community saying, hey, Obama administration, you kind of messed up here. Right. And the Democrats have had a very tough time dealing with that issue.
Well, you know, I want to actually make some room for some of our callers here before we run out of too much time. So let's roll through as many as we can. Let's start with Sandy, who's calling from Siesta Key, Florida. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hello. What the gentleman just said about Joe Biden and his record with Obama is correct. But you can go back further than that. And I think this can unite Latino and African-American voters. They need to realize that Joe Biden did not do anything to help anyone that was in prison during the crime bill. He did nothing. The man is not for any of those people, really, no matter how much he smiles or what. And that is my opinion of Joe Biden. And he I mean, it's on the record. And Tom Steyer tried to bring it out on stage. And all he did is turn to him and go, it's a lie. It's a lie. And it's not a lie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Sandy, so, I'm going to take it back from you there, only because we're running out of time and I want to get some more callers in here. But I appreciate your call. Let's go to Jose, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jose, you're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you for allowing me to participate. I actually bring a little bit of personal experience perspective on the what we are hoping from the candidates. First of all, I want to tell you that I have been 22 years in the United States. 18 of those protected by TPS, Temporary Protected Status, which is a program that is in the chopping block right now. What I would like to see from candidates, first of all, they have been taking, especially the Democratic Party, have been taking the Latino vote for granted. That's one thing I would like to see them changing. I would like to see them talking about specific policies and steps they will take to fix some of the problems that are already happening in our country. For example, I am so devastated that I haven't heard specifically steps that they will take to protect TPS recipients. I have seen some things on written on paper from Bernie Sanders, for example, but I would like him to talk about what he's going to do. He's not talking about. So the other side is destroying us, telling that every immigrant, we are criminals, we are this. Where are the Democratic candidates? They need to talk about the issue. They need let me tell you something. They are using, we need to fix and we need to pass immigration reform. Many of us actually, we get angry when we hear that they want to pass immigration reform, when we know they are just using it as a talking point and are not giving a specific steps in how they're going to do it.
Right. Well, Jose, let me take it back from you because we're just running out of time and I want to get our panel to respond to your point. So thank you so much for your call. Sonia, let me start with you. I mean, this is on the Democratic side of things. I would say this is one primary season in which we have had a bumper crop of plans. There is a lot of specificity on a whole variety of issues here. Do you agree with Jose when he says he hasn't seen in like the level of detail that he would like on issues such as protecting people here on TPS?
Yeah, I think that I would definitely agree with Jose. And it's not necessarily just an issue and the fault of the candidates, mm-hmm. but we saw in almost all major presidential debates for the Democratic contest, there were no questions regarding these types of policies. And it's not just about comprehensive immigration reform. People understand that when we talk about expanding health care, that means coverage for everybody. I want to bring up something that I think is really important, and that's history. 25 years ago, California's electorate passed Proposition 187, which mm-hmm. sought to criminalize the access of social services by mm-hmm. immigrants. Yeah. That changed the trajectory and the political power of the state. We now have a state that is controlled by a supermajority of Democrats. The California Republican Party is pretty much dead insofar as it relates to the Latino community. The 2018 midterm in Orange County showed that. Now, we are going to have Arizona cast a meaningful ballot at the same time as Florida. Arizona this year, and this month in particular, is a decade past SB 1070.
Right.
And so what we're seeing is a shift. You can't only demonize, criminalize, and dilute the vote of Latinos, but we really need to think through what party investment is there. And I'll say with regards to immigration, like Geronimo said, there's other issues that are polling higher, and they mm-hmm. have been consistently. But with the president that we have in the White House and the type of rhetoric that we see happening every day and the types of assaults on our communities, including Gilroy and El Paso and the raid in Mississippi, Latino voters want a president who's going to unite the country, who's going to embrace diversity, and who's going to deal with the rampant discrimination that Latinos and other communities of color face.
So, Geronimo, we've only got about a minute left here. I still want to just project forward into November 2020 because I'm still thinking about the fact that 20% of Latino Americans who cast a ballot in 2016 did vote for President Trump.
It's still going to happen.
Yeah. So Geronimo, I mean, in the general election, there's going to be the importance of the Latino vote is true for both parties, is it not?
It is. You cannot win an election without the Latino vote. But here we have to make a very important caveat. And those who are supporting President Trump are a older part of the electorate, of the Latino electorate, tend to be more conservative, tend to be, more wealthier, so on and so forth. So this year, we're going to see a huge incorporation of younger Latino voters that do not necessarily agree with the policies that President Trump has implemented or the rhetoric around those policies. So we're going to see that generational shift from older folks to a more invigorated younger Latino electorate. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're going to see what happens tomorrow and obviously in 2020.
Julio, I'm going to give you the last 20 seconds here.
It's important. We're American voters. I do think the youth vote and the Latino youth vote is critical. It's all about turnout. And even with Trump supporters, there's plenty of young Latinos Trump supporters out there who are, fifth generation, affluent, English speaking, based in Miami, who are never going to vote for a Democrat.
Well, Julio Ricardo Varela, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Geronimo Cortina, Associate Director of the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Houston, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Sonia Diaz, Founding Director of UCLA's Latino Policy and Politics Initiative. Sonia, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.